Model Test 4, Listening Section.
The listening section tests your ability to understand spoken English that is typical of interactions and academic speech on college campuses. During the test, you will respond to conversations and lectures. This is the short format for the listening section. On the short format, you will respond to 2 conversations and 4 lectures. After each listening passage, you will answer 5 to 6 questions about it. You will hear each conversation or lecture 1 time. You may take notes while you listen, but notes are not graded. You may use your notes to answer the questions. Choose the best answer for multiple choice questions. Follow the directions on the page or on the screen for computer-assisted questions. Click on Next and OK to go to the next question. You cannot return to previous questions. You have 25 to 30 minutes to answer all of the questions. A clock on the screen will show you how much time you have to complete your answers for this section. The clock does not count the time you are listening to the conversations and lectures.
Listening 1. Professor's Office.
Listen to part of a conversation on campus between a student and a professor.
So what did you want to see me about, Ernie?
My grade. I'm not doing very well in this class.
Well, that's not exactly true. You were doing very well until the last test.
I got a D, Professor Adams. I've never gotten a D in my life. Before this, I mean. So that's why I'm here. I hope you can give me some advice.
Well, from my class book, I see that your attendance is excellent. No absences, so that's not the problem.
No, I never miss class. I'm a serious student. I just don't know what happened on that test.
Did you bring it, the test?
Yes, I did. Here it is.
Okay, I think I remember this, but there were almost 100 tests to grade, so let's have a look at it.
Thanks.
Well, Ernie, let's see. Here it is. Yes, I do recall this test. You didn't finish it. You stopped after question 15. So you had 5 questions that were counted wrong because you didn't complete the test.
I know. I didn't watch the time, and I just couldn't believe it when you asked us to hand in the tests.
Yes, I see. But you did a good job on the questions that you did respond to.
Professor Adams, maybe you won't believe me, but I know the answers to the questions
The ones that you left blank at the end.
Yeah. So now I need some advice about how to bring up my grade because a D is going to make a big difference.
This test counts 25%, so you're right. It will bring it down at least a letter.
I know.
Okay, then. The first thing's to learn something from this. You have to find a way to pace yourself through tests, or you're going to have this problem again.
I know. And believe me, I learned that already.
Okay, that's good. Now, what about the grade for this class?
I was hoping you might give me a chance to maybe do an extra credit assignment.
I don't know about that.
Oh.
But here's what we can do. If you want to finish the test right now and your answers are satisfactory, then I'll add some points to your grade.
You will? I know the answers, really.
I can't give you full credit for your answers. That wouldn't be fair to the other students. But I can add some points, and that should help you somewhat.
Wow. This is great.
Okay, just take your test over there and finish it. You had about an hour to complete 20 questions, so that would be 15 minutes to finish the 5 questions you left blank. And Ernie, pace yourself.
I will. Thanks. Thanks a lot.
1. Why does the man go to see his professor? Two. Why did Ernie get a low grade on the last test? Three. What do we know about the test? Four. Listen again to part of the conversation, and then answer the following question.
I was hoping you might give me a chance to maybe do an extra credit assignment.
I don't know about that.
Why does the professor say this?
I don't know about that.
Five. What can be inferred about the professor?
Listening to Anthropology class.
Listen to part of a lecture in an anthropology class. The professor is discussing agriculture.
Let's just pick up where we left off last week. Okay, as you recall, earlier theories about the development of agriculture tended to view it as a progressive event, or even as a catalyst for everything from art to industry. But I'm going to share a rather different view with you. From a revisionist perspective, the development of agriculture about 10,000 years ago didn't improve the lives of early farmers. On the contrary, when hunter-gatherers abandoned the age-old method of foraging for food and began to cultivate crops, they put their health at risk. Now, I know it's just the opposite of, it's quite a different viewpoint, let's say. So, why would this be so? Why would their health decline when agriculture provided people with an efficient way to get more food for less work? Clearly, cultivated fields yield more food per acre than uncultivated land with undomesticated patches of berries and nuts. Well, first, let's consider the conditions that are necessary for agriculture to flourish. In order to have enough labor to plant, tend, and harvest crops, a larger number of people have to cooperate. That means that the density of the population must increase in the area surrounding the cultivated farms. And as we know, crowding contributes to the transmission of infectious diseases. So, when hunter-gatherers were wandering in small bands, the likelihood of an epidemic was slight. But, after the agricultural revolution, tuberculosis, diseases of the intestinal tract, these began to reach epidemic proportions in the crowded agricultural communities. And in addition, because the population was no longer mobile and relied on trade to inject variety into the lives and diets of the farmers, that meant that disease was also transmitted through the exchange of goods. Now, the revisionists also argue that the content of the diet for early farmers was inferior to that of the hunter-gatherers. You recall that hunter-gatherers enjoyed a variety of foods selected from wild plants and game, and in studies of modern tribes that have continued the tradition of hunting and gathering food, it appears that those, the hunters and gatherers, they have a better balance of nutrients and even more protein than tribes that have adopted agricultural lifestyles. Today, three grain crops, wheat, corn, and rice, these account for the bulk of calories consumed by farming societies. So, consider the implications. Extrapolating from this and from evidence that early farmers raised only one or two crops, we can conclude that a disproportionate amount of carbohydrates formed the basis of their diets. Now, another interesting series of studies involved the skeletal remains of hunter-gatherers as compared with their agricultural relatives. And one such study from Greece and Turkey, it indicates that the average height of hunter-gatherers at the end of the Ice Age was, let me check my notes. Yes, it was 5 foot 9 inches for men and 5 foot 5 inches for women. And their bones were strong, healthy, and athletic. But after the agricultural revolution, skeletal remains revealed that height had diminished to a shocking 5 foot 3 inches for men and 5 foot for women. And evidence from bone samples suggests that they suffered from diseases caused by malnutrition, like anemia. And this is interesting. Further studies from paleontologists at the University of Massachusetts project life expectancies for hunter-gatherers at about 26 years, but post-agricultural life expectancies were less than 20 years. Let me just read you something from one of the studies by George Amalagos, and I quote, "Episodes of nutritional stress and infectious disease were seriously affecting their ability to survive." And he's referring to early farmers here. So, let's see where we are. Oh, yes. Consider that hunter-gatherers had the advantage of mobility. So if food wasn't plentiful, they broke camp and moved on in search of an area with a larger food supply. And if one type of food were in short supply, for example, well, berries, then they wouldn't eat berries. But there would probably be a good supply of another type of food, like nuts. Or hunting might compensate for a bad year for plant foods. But farmers were very vulnerable to crop failures. Remember, most early farmers cultivated only one or two crops. If there was a drought and the grain harvest failed, they didn't have other resources. And that's why they were subject to malnutrition or even starvation. So, as you see, revisionists have made a rather convincing case. To sum it up, according to the revisionists, the development of agriculture put the health of early farmers at risk.
6. Which of the following is the main topic of the lecture? Seven. What are two key characteristics of hunter-gatherers mentioned in the lecture? Eight. Listen again to part of the lecture and then answer the following question.
So, let's see where we are. Oh, yes. Consider that hunter-gatherers had the advantage of mobility.
Why does the professor say this?
Oh, yes.
Nine. How does the professor organize his lecture? Ten. Which of the following statements best summarizes the position of the revisionists? Eleven. In the lecture, the professor describes the relationship between health and agriculture. Indicate whether each of the following is true or false. Click in the correct box for each phrase.
Listening 3. Business class.
Listen to part of a lecture in a business class.
In your textbook, the author states that companies sell products, but companies market brands. And several of you have asked me about that distinction between selling products and marketing brands. I thought we ought to take some time to talk about it in class. So let me give you an example. Suppose that we have a company and the product's chicken. Then it's easy to understand that we're selling chicken. Maybe we're even selling a special preparation of chicken. Barbecued chicken, and maybe we include lemonade and a hot roll free with our barbecued chicken. We may even have the best service, but we're still selling chicken, even though it's a special preparation, and even though we've provided an attractive package with free additional products and good service. All of that's still selling. But what's marketing then? Well, when we market a product, we have to create meaning that attaches itself to the product. Something that makes the product more unique and more desirable than other similar products. Maybe this chicken was a family recipe that was handed down from Aunt Ruby. So this isn't just chicken, it's Aunt Ruby's recipe. And eating it's special because she doesn't give the recipe to anyone but family, and being in the restaurant is just like being in Aunt Ruby's kitchen. How you interpret the experience is just as important as how you view the product. See what I mean? Take a look at commercials on television if you really want to understand marketing, because these commercials almost always represent the product as something else. Success, sex, youth, all of these are important to the consumer. So when a car's marketed, for example, it's shown in the context of a successful crowd of people in an upscale neighborhood, or the man who buys the car gets the woman. Or the woman who buys the car is young, beautiful, and desirable while she's driving it. And marketing's what attaches that meaning to the product. You may not be able to buy youth, but you can buy products, and the message is that these products will get you what you really want. Okay, so marketing, selling an image or a benefit, something that's really attractive and larger than the product itself, and by attaching it to the product, we can give that larger meaning to what we want to sell. Go back to the car commercial for a minute. We want to sell cars, but we market them by selling something bigger first, and by association, we sell the cars. This brings us to the term branding. Now, branding is similar to marketing because the customer perceives the product as being valuable. So then, branding's more about the customer than it is about the product. It's the personality of the product that people relate to. Think Allstate Insurance, and you'll probably come up with, "You're in good hands." And their competitor, State Farm, will remind you, "Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there." This is an emotional relationship that customers have with the personality of the product. Rob Frankel's probably one of the most widely respected business consultants in the area of product branding. In his book, The Revenge of Brand X, he says business is about relationships, not about transactions. That's not an exact quote, but it's close. And he's so right on. Branding isn't about the product or even about the customer service. It's about the customer's perception of the product and the relationship with the personality of the product. And that's how branding works. So it's not a logo, it's not a name, although name recognition or the familiarity of a logo is helpful. It's not a commercial or even a string of commercials in a marketing plan. It's more about loyalty and confidence and all of the things that make a relationship good. Customers have to do more than recognize the brand. They have to be motivated to buy it and continue to buy it over time. In a way, it's a telegraphic marketing message that's easy to understand and speaks to the customer. And it has to be a consistent message. I mean that to build a brand, and more important, brand loyalty, you have to repeat that message over and over. Say it loud enough and long enough, and it starts to sound right. And even more important, it starts to echo in your customers' heads when they think about making a purchase. So what's the result that we're going for? It's when the customer will wait until the store gets more of it instead of buying a different brand. Or if the price goes up, the customer will pay extra instead of buying a cheaper brand. And this is brand loyalty, which is especially important in an industry where there isn't very much difference in the competing products. Laundry detergent. Now, that's really a very similar product across brands, but people tend to buy the same one. Okay, then. How do we give our products a personality so we can develop a relationship with customers? Well, Aunt Ruby's someone that we can relate to when we think about chicken. But celebrity spokespersons are an even more obvious option. When kids think about Nike shoes, do they want a relationship with a shoe, with Nike, or with Michael Jordan? It's pretty obvious that Air Jordan shoes are all about the basketball player. That's taking branding to its logical conclusion.
12. What is the lecture mainly about? Thirteen. Listen again to part of the lecture and then answer the following question.
Go back to the car commercial for a minute. We want to sell cars, but we market them by selling something bigger first. And by association, we sell the cars.
Why does the professor say this?
Go back to the car commercial for a minute.
14. According to the professor, why do consumers develop brand loyalty? How does the professor emphasize his point about branding? 16. Why does the professor mention laundry detergent? 17. According to the professor, what would be a good way to sell a product?
4. Students on campus.
Listen to part of a conversation on campus between two students.
This is an interesting assignment.
It is. I'm just having a problem figuring out how to write up the report.
Oh? How much have you done?
Well, the introduction was easy. I just expanded on the information that the lab assistant provided, you know, about the effects of alcohol on reflexes, and I used the same references that he cited.
Me too.
Then I described the experiment in the second part, the methods and materials section.
What did you include there? The lab assistant said that it was important to be specific when we did this part.
Yeah, he did. So I mentioned that there were 10 subjects, and 5 were drinking gin and tonic, but the other 5, that's the control group, they were drinking tonic only, and no one knew which group was which. Then they each had to drive in a computerized, a simulator of a car that was supposed to be moving at 35 miles an hour. And when they saw a bicycle, they were supposed to hit the brakes.
So far, so good. The only thing I can think of that you might want to add is maybe a little more about the subjects. I think they were college students, and they were selected at random to be in the experimental or control group.
Good idea, especially the part about the random selection. That would be important information if someone wanted to duplicate the experiment. And didn't he say that this section had to be specific enough for another researcher to be able to
Replicate?
Yeah, replicate the study.
Okay. So what did you do with the results section?
That's the problem. I can't seem to figure out what to put in the results section and what to use for the discussion section. If I put the chart with the reaction times in the results, should I explain the chart in the discussion or what?
Oh, now I see the problem. The chart's fairly self-explanatory, isn't it? I mean, it's really a simple chart to read.
That's what I thought.
But you still have to explain the chart in the results section.
You do?
Yeah. Look, here's what I'd do. I'd look at the chart and try to come up with a few general statements. For example, all of the subjects who were drinking alcohol had longer reaction times. Then you can look at the range, 1 second to 4 seconds for the subjects who are drinking only tonic, and that's compared with 3 seconds to 20 seconds for the subjects who are drinking gin with the tonic.
So I'm really just repeating what's on the chart, but I'm explaining it in words.
Right. But here's the thing. You shouldn't draw any conclusions in the results section, just the facts.
You mean just what happened in the experiment?
Right. You have to save the conclusions for the discussion section.
Okay, so in the conclusions, I might say that driving after having 4 drinks, if you have 4 drinks, you probably won't be in a position to avoid an accident.
That's good. And you could also point out problems in the research, if there are any, or suggestions for future research.
Like doing the experiment with beer instead of hard liquor, or repeating the same experiment with 3 drinks instead of 4.
Sure, that's the idea.
18. What is the purpose of this conversation? 19. What is the study about? 20. According to the man, why is it important to mention that the subjects were randomly selected? 21. Listen again to part of the conversation, and then answer the following question.
Oh, now I see the problem. The chart's fairly self-explanatory, isn't it? I mean, it's really a simple chart to read.
That's what I thought.
Why does the woman say this?
The chart's fairly self-explanatory, isn't it?
Which section includes the conclusions?
5. Biology class.
Listen to part of a lecture in a biology class. The professor is discussing blood types.
Before we begin our discussion of blood types, let's review what we know about blood. According to the textbooks, about half of the volume of blood is made up of blood cells that begin as stem cells in bone marrow. And these stem cells can develop into any of the other kinds of cells found in blood, including red cells, white cells, and platelets. So, some stem cells become white cells or leukocytes, and these are essential to the immune system. And when bacteria or germs invade the body, some of the white cells form antibodies to resist the infection directly, while other white cells begin to work on the chemistry of the foreign substance itself to fight the infection. Now, compared with red blood cells, there are relatively few white blood cells, only about 1 for every 700 red cells, and the smallest of the blood cells are called platelets. But what they don't have in size, they make up for in numbers. Well, most of us have about 2 trillion of them, and they work to help the blood to clot and repair holes in the walls of blood vessels. But we need a way to transport the blood, right? Plasma's the liquid substance in blood that transports most of the chemicals, vitamins, minerals, hormones, and enzymes. But most stem cells become red blood cells, or erythrocytes. They're the most numerous. As I mentioned before, there are about 700 to every 1 white blood cell. So the red cells give blood the color red. And they're important for what we call blood typing. And blood typing's what I want to get going on today. Now, blood types are a classification of red blood cells according to the presence of specific substances, antigenic proteins, and carbohydrates. And you can see them under the microscope on the surface of the cells. The 4 blood types are identified by letters A, B, AB, and O. Blood type A contains red blood cells with the antigen A. Blood type B contains red blood cells with the antigen B. The AB blood type contains both antigens, and the O blood type contains no antigens. But the individual with this type can form antibodies containing either A or B antigens.
Excuse me, is that why the O blood type's considered a universal blood type? Because it can form antibodies with either A or B antigens?
Right, you are. But in typing the blood, the antigens are really much more complex than this explanation might suggest. There are at least 300 different antigens. In fact, there are so many potential combinations that an individual's blood type's almost as unique as a fingerprint. But anyway, these basic types are used for determining compatibilities for blood transfusions. Before a transfusion's approved, hospitals always perform a procedure called a cross-match, which involves taking a sample of the donor's red blood cells and mixing them with a sample of the patient's plasma. You see, in almost every individual, the plasma contains antibodies that will react to antigens that aren't found on their own red blood cells. So during a transfusion, antibodies in the patient's plasma can bind to antigens on the donor's red blood cells when the donor's blood isn't similar to that of the patient. Well, many minor reactions can occur, like fever or chills, but some reactions are so severe that they lead to a spontaneous destruction of the red blood cells from the donor, and that can result in shock or even death. so you can understand why blood typing is so important. Cross-matching lowers the risk of a serious reaction. Okay, in cross-matching, we take red cells from one person and plasma from the other person, and we watch to see whether there's a negative response. Take a look at this diagram. It's on page 112 in your textbook. Here's what you'd be looking at with a reaction caused by incompatible blood. See how the cells clump together? The reason that this is happening is because there's a chemical reaction between the protein molecules in the red cells of one person and the plasma of the other. Now, look at this slide. This diagram's on the next page in your text, and this shows a compatible match with no clumping. See how the cells are evenly spaced? Well, of course, doctors prefer to use the same type as that of the patient, but compromises have to be made in emergencies. Type A patients can't receive type B blood, and type B patients can't receive type A blood. But back to your question, since an O donor has blood that's compatible with both A and B antigens, it's the ideal, or as you said, the universal donor. In an emergency, type O blood can be used for patients of all blood types. And fortunately, worldwide, type O's the most common, followed by type A. Relatively few people have type B blood, and the fewest have type AB.
Professor Stevens, can you tell us anything about artificial blood?
Well, actually, scientists have developed artificial blood that's been used successfully in blood transfusions with human patients. It's a white fluid, chemically similar to Teflon, the material that coats cookware and prevents material from adhering to it. The fluid can be used as a match with all blood types, and so the cross-matching step in transfusions, that can be eliminated. So far, artificial blood has done a good job of replacing the red cells by carrying oxygen through the body and eliminating carbon dioxide. But there are no white cells present, no antibodies, no platelets, so it doesn't clot, and it doesn't remain in the body very long. Still, continuing research along these lines should probably be encouraged. Even with cross-matching and other precautions, transfusions with human blood involve risks.
23. What aspect of blood does the professor mainly discuss? Listen again to part of the lecture, and then answer the following question.
Excuse me, is that why the O blood type's considered a universal blood type? Because it can form antibodies with either A or B antigens?
Right you are.
Why does the student say this?
Excuse me,
why does the professor mention fingerprints? 26. In cross-matching, how does a compatible match appear under the microscope? 27. Why does the professor mention artificial blood? 28. Listen again to part of the lecture and then answer the following question.
Still, continuing research along these lines should probably be encouraged. Even with cross-matching and other precautions, transfusions with human blood involve risks.
What does the professor imply when she says this?
Still, continuing research along these lines should probably be encouraged.
6. Orientation session.
Listen to part of a discussion in an orientation class.
For the most part, college students don't read fast enough to keep up with the demands of their reading assignments. Let's just say that the typical college student reads 150 to 300 words per minute. Okay. The professor in the Western Civilization course uses the topics from Chapter 1 of the textbook for 3 lectures the first week of the semester. Each page has about 500 words on it, and that includes space for pictures and drawings. So, at 150 words per minute, let me see, each page will take more than 3 minutes to complete, and if my figures are right, that's almost 3 hours just to read the textbook assignment once through. That doesn't even count what you need to do to think and connect the lectures with the book. And you can be sure that there'll be additional reading or other assignments besides the lectures and the textbook. Have you heard about the times two rule?
Doesn't that mean a student should spend 2 hours of study time for every hour of class time in every subject?
Exactly. Okay. I think you'll agree that reading faster is important to success in college, so it's only practical to learn to read faster. And that's why I'm going to talk with you about the human capacity for reading and some habits that you may have that could be slowing you down. First, I want you to think about reading like you think about running. The more you run, the faster and farther you can go. And the more you read, the faster you're going to read. In fact, researchers hypothesize that our physical capacity to read surpasses our ability to turn the pages. In other words, our brains can take in the information faster than our hands can move. So reading 700 to 1,000 words a minute should be a reasonable goal for almost everyone. That'd be quite a time saver, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it sure would.
Now, let's talk about why most of us probably aren't reading at that speed. At 1,000 words a minute, why we're not doing that now. We know that we have the capacity, that our brains can take it in. But there are a few habits that prevent readers from reaching that target speed of 700 to 1,000 words. In the first place, some people are auditory readers. That means that they hear every word in their minds. Some people even move their lips so they seem to be speaking while they're reading. This is a serious problem because we can only speak about 300 words per minute, but our capacity to read, it's many times faster. So if you're hearing the words in your head or moving your lips, you know that you're preventing your mind from processing as fast as it can. Can any of you relate to that?
I can. I hear every word.
A lot of people do. Now, another problem, something called fixations. Fixations are the actual pauses that the eye makes. We can't see while the eye's moving, so we have to stop to take in the text. Everyone has to fixate to see the print. But some people, they stop their eyes on every single word, and that'll really slow you down. So if you're looking at every word or even at every few words, that habit's something to work on. When you're not reading word by word, your mind has to connect and build associations and patterns. You can do this because so much of a written text is redundant. That means that there's a lot of repetition. So quite a few words can be skipped without losing the meaning.
So you're saying we should try to guess the meaning?
I think I would use the term predict rather than guess. But basically the answer to your question's yes. Now this may surprise you. Using a dictionary is a good habit, right? Well, yes. In moderation. But stopping to look up every new word's a bad habit because you don't need to know every word in order to understand what you're reading. Remember what I just said about redundancy? So, stopping to use the dictionary too often, that interrupts your train of thought and prevents you from reaching your potential reading speed.
I've heard that before and it makes sense, but...
But you're afraid to try it?
That's probably true.
Well, I'll come back to that in a minute. First, I want to point out one more problem. A lot of readers go back over the words they've already read to clarify the meaning. But this is probably the worst habit because when we're repeating twice or even more times, that causes our reading speed to drop. and it goes to 50 or even 30% of our capacity. Did I mention that this is called regression? Okay, well, this regression not only slows us down, it also makes it more difficult to understand the meaning because the way that we comprehend, we understand by connecting with the next phrase. So going back all the time makes us lose the connections. And this is what's really important in all of this. Research demonstrates a correlation between speed and comprehension. In an overwhelming number of cases, when students increase their reading speed, they also increase their comprehension of the material. So, how can you do this? First, break the habits that are causing you to read slowly. Don't think the words in your head or move your lips to sound out each word. Don't let your eyes pause on every word. Don't look up every new word in the dictionary. And try not to go back over paragraphs and sentences that you've already read. But that's hard to do if you have these habits, isn't it? Especially if you're also trying to read in order to learn a new subject. That's why you're afraid to try it. Because, you have to learn the content in order to pass the course, and you don't want to try something new to take a risk.
Yeah, that's about the size of it.
Well, I understand that. But you can take a risk and try to change some of those habits, but it helps if you do it in a structured environment, like the Learning Center. It's free, and you'll more than make up for the time you spend in one of the reading courses they offer when you begin to read all of your assignments at twice the speed you're reading them now.
29. What is this discussion mainly about? How does the professor organize the discussion? 31. Why does the professor mention running? 32. Listen again to part of the discussion and then answer the following question.
Well, I'll come back to that in a minute. First, I want to point out one more problem.
Why does the professor say this?
Well, I'll come back to that in a minute.
33. The professor mentions several negative habits. Match these habits to the explanations. Click on the habit and drag it to the correct explanation. 34. What would the professor probably like the students to do?